Welcome to 709 Watershed, sponsored by Newfoundland and Labrador Hydro.
Hey everybody, I'd like to welcome you to the first ever 709 Watershed podcast. I'm your host Darren Shepherd, co-host Nicholas Saunders, and sound guru Jordan Nee will guide you through the exciting and interesting world of environmental discussion, ecotourism, watershed news, local, provincial, and national issues and stories, plus anything else that may pop into our heads as we move along here. In today's first episode, fish management within Newfoundland Labrador Hydro's hydroelectric system. Newfoundland Labrador Hydro is the main power generator within the province's electrical system. Its hydroelectric system uses the same rivers and waterways that salmon and trout use, such as the Exploits River, Granite Canal, etc. Working with the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, along with other stakeholders, Newfoundland Hydro is a key participant of fisheries management and protection. In this episode, we'll be interviewing Rod Healy, Manager of Environmental Operations, regarding Hydro's commitment to ensuring healthy salmon and trout stocks while producing the province's electricity. Welcome, Rod.
Great to be here, Darren.
Appreciate it. If you don't mind, provide our listeners, what exactly is Hydro's job?
Well, I guess to get a background on Newfoundland Labrador Hydro is, it's a Crown Corporation, so it's owned solely by the government, and it manages and operates the provincial electricity grid. Hydro is the main producer of electricity in the province. Through generation, transmission, distribution, Hydro's goal is to meet the needs of customers to provide safe, reliable power to residents, businesses, communities across Newfoundland and Labrador. And we provide power to families, friends, and neighbors to about 200-plus communities.
Awesome. So operating the province's electricity system is a fairly big job. Where are the environmental aspects that go along with that mandate? Because I'm assuming it is a mandate that's something that you have to provide the power.
No, absolutely. And that's a key component to it too, Darren. I mean, obviously it's a big system. It's a complicated system, as you can imagine. And there are, environmental impacts that we have to mitigate. And we understand those day-to-day operations, and they can have an impact on the and communities in which we operate. So, we understand that there is an environmental footprint that we have to manage and mitigate. So we take that responsibility serious, and we work every day to minimize our potential impacts to any environmental impact we may have, whether it's an operational issue, whether it's, we're building something from a capital perspective. We want to make sure that we're identifying and mitigating any environmental impacts that we could have. We're also focused on being environmentally and socially responsible. So it's just not the environmental side, but also the social responsibility side. So, it's the triple bottom line, we call it. So, you're talking not only the environmental side, the social side, but it's also the economic side of it, too. So, we want to make sure that we, in everything we do, while maintaining our, our safety and reliability and so on, related to our environmental, footprint, and everything related to our electricity assets.
Fair enough.
And that means managing risks and minimizing our environmental impact. So anything we do, obviously, from an environmental perspective, is all about risk mitigation. And we want to make sure that we put the proper process in place to ensure that the risks associated with it are minimized. Because you're not going to eliminate it, but you're going to try to minimize it to the best of your ability.
That's true. Very true. Tell us a little bit more about Hydro's commitment to environmental responsibility and just that mandate itself as well.
Sure. Well, in Newfoundland Labrador Hydro, we have an environmental service department. So we have basically seven people, including myself, me being the manager of environmental services for Hydro. We have two environmental specialists and four environmental advisors. The way it's broken down, as I explained it, we have our generation or transmission distribution. We have an environmental specialist solely related to our production side, so our generation side. And we also have an environmental specialist related to our transmission distribution side. And then we have two coordinators that fill in on both of those sides to ensure that we have good coverage. So we look at it from a point of view of, if it's a capital job, we go in advance and do the assessment of the work. So basically looking at our potential environmental impacts we have to mitigate. So we're out ahead of the, say, the construction. I guess from an operations perspective, we look at the day-to-day stuff. So we're looking at, you know, whether it's managing, you know, fuel handling and storage at our diesel plants to something that's related to our thermal generating plant at Holyrood. You know, we're pretty much, you know, in the day-to-day business as much, you know, as the big projects like some of our, I guess, the new assets like our transmission line on from Beta Spear to its Chapel RMTL 267. I guess as part of that too, we have what's called an environmental management system, and it's an ISO certified system, which is basically an international organization for standardization. So it's a worldwide standard that companies follow. So we have an ISO certified environmental management system that I guess is a system that manages our environmental impacts. So we look at it from a point of view of our highest potential impacts to our lowest potential impacts. And the ones that come out the highest, obviously, we put our main focus on. And as you can well imagine, in our system, like I mentioned, from generation, transmission, distribution, we look at it from a point of view of what's our biggest risk. So we try to manage those the best way we can through our system. So it's a plan, do, check, act system where we basically do the planning, we do the mitigation and the management of it, and we also do the checking at the back end to make sure we're doing a good job. So it's a system that we had in place for since 1999 with our certification of our thermal plant in Holyrood. And just in 2015, they changed some of the standard to include some additions. And one of the ones that we basically included was our focus from our leadership perspective. So I guess it's the old standard had some wording around, you know, one person basically managing the system. They've seen that as a bit of a shortfall, and they basically changed the standard to include leadership. So basically, from a management system point of view, you want to make sure your leadership's engaged, and that's one of the positive changes that happened back in 2005. So, you know, it's something that we have at Hydro. I'm quite proud of the system that we have. It's, you know, it's a system that shows continual improvement. So not only are you managing your environmental aspects, but you're also ensuring that there is continual improvement from a year-to-year basis. So we have basically environmental targets and objectives that we set every year. And based on our work plan or based on, you know, various components of our operations that we feel that we need to improve on, and also to manage our environmental aspects. So those significant ones that I mentioned to you earlier, we look at those to make sure that we're managing those in a fashion that we see improvement on. The checking part of it, we have auditing that gets done in our system from an internal perspective, and also it's a registered system, so we actually have a body outside of our own corporation that comes in and audits our system. So from a yearly basis, I mean, we can't not show continual improvement. We have to make sure we're following the standard and showing continual improvement. So it's something that we, you know, there's a lot of checks and balances in the system. We're quite proud of where we're to. So not to say it's a perfect system. But to say that we do have a system, at least we can fall back on it from a point of view of, you know, we can show, you know, that it's working. We can show that we're meeting our objectives and targets from a yearly basis, and we can show continual improvement.
This segment is sponsored by the Homestead Adventures, The Adventure Starts With You, and Hare Bay Adventures, Let's Make Your Adventure Happen.
You were speaking about you got a 7-person crew there doing this. Is everybody based in St. John's, or are you spread out throughout the island, or is it kind of like on a need-to-need basis you'll ship out to a project site when you have to go out and check on things?
Yeah, no, good question, Darren. We're pretty much all over the province from a departmental point of view, but we also have embedded resources in our regions. So, and they may be a dual focus. Some are safety, some are, I guess not safety, but they're environment and safety, sorry. And but there is environmental focus. So in each one of our areas, for example, in our thermal plants in Holyrood, our transmission rural operations in Central, our hydro generation facilities in Beta Spear and in Exploits, we do have embedded resources. So it's kind of like a dotted line to myself. So they do have management responsibility in the regions, but I can also have some influence of what they do in the field.
Okay, that's good. Just a little background about me, too. I used to work security for Newfoundland Hydro Contracting in Holyrood. So I've actually been throughout the station out there and all over the place. So it's bringing back memories of the steam and the noise from the facility, but I did enjoy it working there. So that's kudos to Newfoundland Hydro for that.
Yeah, no, for sure. And like I said, if you've been at Hydro in the thermal facility, you've pretty much seen, one of the workhorses for the province, for sure.
Mm-hmm, definitely. So generally, how do you manage or approach environmental issues at Newfoundland Hydro?
Well, I guess there's several ways we approach them. I guess our environmental management system kind of kicks in and kind of makes us aware of some of the potential significant ones that we may have. From a project perspective, we also have issues obviously that we have to manage from that perspective, and there's various things that we do. So we do have, from a project perspective, environmental effects monitoring plans. Mm-hmm. And Hole River, you mentioned, we do have a marine environmental effects monitoring program. For TL-267, there's environmental monitoring that we have to do. So any of the big projects, we kind of enter into an agreement as part of the release from an environmental assessment process that we may have to follow, and a lot of that comes out of the process. But we do have plans in place, and through these plans, we develop environmental effects monitoring to ensure that the project or the thing that we're doing, the project we're doing, does not have a long-term effect on the environment. As mentioned, as part of our generation or transmission distribution, we do have many large power generation plants, like you mentioned, Holyrood, hydroelectric dams, mm-hmm. and of course extensive transmission and distribution systems, and roughly about 50 terminal stations and, like I said, thousands of kilometers of transmission distribution line. So to maintain, so it's a fairly significant system, and it extends right from, say, the Avalon right on through to North Coast of Labrador.
Yeah, true.
And just speaking about the North Coast, I mean, in the rural isolated diesel plants, we do have a lot of things going on there. Obviously, I mean, for one, they're isolated, so there's no connection to the grid, so therefore it's diesel fuel, and there's all kinds of lubricants that we have to manage. For example, in Nain, I mean, there's just from a fuel storage perspective, you can imagine it's a long winter, so it starts basically, our last fill up is in December. Our next one is not until July, so you're talking, half a year of potential storage, and you're into the, 1.5 million liters of fuel that's actually stored on site to get them through to that period. So that's a lot of management. It's a lot of checks and balances, a lot of, preventative measures put in place to ensure that we don't have any large spills or leaks from our system. So it's a constant process. And again, our environmental management system helps us direct that process when we do it, to ensure that we do have the proper processes and checks and balances in place. We do have standard operating procedures to follow in the event when we do check the storage tanks or lube oil facilities or our diesel plants in general, that the environmental considerations are also checked off. So, for example, if we do have lube oil stored out on a lube oil storage ramp, that the operators are going around on a periodic basis, probably daily, to ensure that there's no leaks or spills from these areas.
Yeah, and that's similar to what I had to do as well. I used to go around and just check and see if there's anything leaking from the tanks in Hydro and in Holyrood. And like I said, we had to do it at least several times a day. And I know the employees directly themselves, they would go around in the tank yard and check on things as well. So this is definitely bringing back memories. So.
No, absolutely. And like I said, it's something that we do, and we would do it anyways from a, environmental responsibility point of view, that we would make sure that this is done. But I guess our system also puts that extra layer of, requirement on there to ensure that it gets done. Because, again, someone in the back end is going to be checking to make sure it gets done. So if we say we're going to do it, mm-hmm. someone in the back end is going to make sure that it actually gets done.
Sure. Okay. Can you give us an example of a larger project and exactly what's involved with a fish, wildlife, and habitat perspective?
Yeah, sure. I guess I just mentioned the TL-267 project. That's probably our latest hydro project that we just built from Beta Spear to Chapel Arm, and runs through the Beta Nord Wilderness Reserve. So it's a fairly sensitive area, as you can imagine. When we did the environmental assessment for that, there was a lot of, back and forth with the regulator to make sure that, obviously, we weren't opening up the center of the province to, people going in there, to do certain things from a hunting, fishing that we're not authorized to do so. So I guess from that perspective, it was identified that the boreal felt lichen was identified there. There's obviously the Middle Ridge caribou herd that's identified as, that's their area of habitat. And also then, too, we have, there's numerous water course crossings. I think there was up to about 200 water course crossings that we had to make sure that we protected in various stages. So I guess we come to some agreement internally what we would do, and basically in some cases, as you can imagine with this transmission line, things have changed from 20 years ago to now. The equipment's getting bigger. So in order to build this line, we actually had to build a road in through from one end of the province to the other, so to get cranes in to erect these towers. So it was quite the undertaking, as you can imagine, and you know, a lot of places that had larger rivers and streams, we had to actually put bridges in. So you know, when we actually did that, there was committing, you know, you're committing to minimizing your potential impact. So you're not crossing the rivers and streams. You're actually, you know, building a bridge and putting it over the top. So you're mitigating the potential of stream habitat and destruction and disturbance. So, you know, when it comes to that, you know, your sedimentation, your alteration of potential spawning habitat, potential spills and leaks from equipment. So, I mean, when you're crossing a river, which is purely, you know, you're allowed to do it. There's nothing to say you can't cross a river or stream with a piece of equipment, but you know, obviously you had to make sure you're following a certain process. You had to make sure that the water levels are at a certain depth. You can't do it at high flows because there's a potential for, you know, that piece of equipment to get stuck in the river.
Yeah.
So it has to be certain criteria met and followed when you do this type of thing. So, you know, it was a fairly intensive process. It was a fairly intensive process with the regulator to make sure that we were doing what we were supposed to do. And obviously, it's through that process we had to make sure that we were following our process for permitting. So, again, it was 200-plus water course crossings from one end to the other. And we had to go and assess all these areas and see where we were going to put what mitigation in place. Some might have been a timber crib bridge. Other places we actually put a Bailey bridge in. And other places were just culverts. So depending on the size of the area, at the end of the project, basically, as I mentioned, with the access concerns, we actually had to go in then and remediate that transmission line access. So we had to remove the culverts, the necessary ones. We had to remove the bridges and to eliminate, I guess, the potential for people going into the Baden-Ur Wilderness Reserve unauthorized. So that's one of the things that we did. I guess the boreal felt lichen, we committed to a five-year monitoring program, so we're in year three of that. So the boreal felt lichen are endangered. They're on our a list of species at risk.
Yes. Yep.
So basically what we had to do there was relocate. If they were found in a right-of-way where we were cutting, we actually had to relocate them to a location that was off the right-of-way to ensure that you know, the lichen weren't impacted. So we're still monitoring the transplant sites now. We're going to in September to look at those and to see how they're doing. So it's a long-term thing, as you can well imagine. I mean, boreal felt lichen don't grow like the grass. It takes a while, you know, some time for it to take hold of the tree and then to kind of, you know, do its thing and move forward. So it's a fairly extensive process. With caribou, same thing. We had to go out and to monitor. We basically collared so many caribou to see where there, you know, were there any impacts of the line with respect to their migration. So we have to go this fall and then remove them. So we're pretty much at the end of our monitoring of the caribou for TL267. So it's you know, it's a fairly intensive, fairly well thought out process when we do a project like you know, a transmission line, especially through a very sensitive area like we did, to make sure that all our stakeholders are fully aware of the process, even the general public, because of course you know, we had to make them aware of what we're doing. And of course, once we open up that area, I guess there's an expectation of that, you know, they have now access to a new area. So there's a lot of discussions with the general public even to make sure that they're aware that this is only temporary and that, you know, what we put in is going to be taken out. So, and that was, again, a condition of our environmental release that will be done. Again, like I said, with respect to the water course crossings, there's, you know, you have to obtain your necessary permits to carry it to work. You know, we plan it so that we use existing approved ford sites. So when we do this or when we've done the construction, you know, we didn't create any new sites. We actually used sites that were existing. We established buffer zones, so you know, between the areas that to minimize the ground disturbance of the water course. And some activities we actually did when the ground was frozen. So if there was an area that was you know, probably a very wet area, like a bog. We actually waited for the bog area to be frozen before we actually crossed that area to do the work. Right. So there's a lot of things that we did during that project that we, it was a lot of planning, a lot of different process that we put in place to make sure that, that was done properly.
It almost sounds like, because you're talking about permits and things like that, I mean, it's the same scale that we are, except, of course, on a smaller scale. I mean, you got more permits, but, I mean, same thing, before we do any projects in water flows or whatever, we need permits from the government, same with you. The things that you're going on with, I can relate to our own projects that we're doing here on, of course, a much smaller scale, but anything to do with water and environmental impacts, I mean, it's the same regulations. Everything has to be checked once, checked twice, and then, I's dotted and T's crossed. So it's very similar, which is, I didn't expect it kind of a thing, but it is kind of, we're almost connected a little bit. Of course, you're handling a lot more of an environmental risk, I guess, with the mileage you put on, like power lines and whatnot, but it's very similar to the type of business that we're both involved with.
No, absolutely. And I mean, the regulations are the regulations, as you know, Darren.
Yep.
I mean, it applies to all people dealing with, crossing rivers or dealing any work in water. You have a permitting process through Water Resources Division and through Department of Fisheries and Oceans.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yep.
You have to follow the process, which we do. We're no different than anyone else. So, I guess another thing to identify there too, Darren, when we do this work on TL-267, we had environmental monitors on the field. So we had boots on the ground to ensure that, what we actually said, committed to, was actually getting done. So it wasn't free rein for the contractor to do, whatever he wanted to. We had boots on the ground to make sure that what we said we were going to do was getting done, and to ensure that, things were done as per permits. As like I said, every permit comes with a list of conditions that you had to follow.
Mm-hmm.
The regulations are pretty prescriptive on what you can and can't do. So our environmental monitors were out there on a daily basis to ensure that the regulations were being followed and that the conditions and the approvals were also being followed.
This segment is sponsored by Carter's Dairy, Bakery, Deli, and Gas Bar, the convenience of variety all in one place, offering the best food around the loop. Hub of the North, Star of Greens Pond, and Norton's Cove Studio and Cafe.
Let's talk a bit more about Fish Resources and Hydro's interaction there. As a company that produces power and owns several dams and facilities across the province, I imagine managing river flows and the impacts on trout or salmon is something you're directly involved in.
Absolutely. And I guess one good example of that, we have several examples, I guess. We've been doing it now since when we built the Bay of Spear system. I mean, we had the Gray and the White Bear River. When we built the Bay of Spear system, they flowed a certain way, and we redirected that flow to go down to the Bay of Spear system. So we actually have an agreement with the Department of Fisheries and Oceans to release water, certain times of year when fish are migrating upstream. So the Gray River and the White Bear River has their own agreements with respect to water releases. So, come June, for example, when the fish are starting to migrate, we actually release so much water from our reservoir to ensure that there's adequate water to help the fish migrate upstream. On a yearly basis, is actually in the millions of dollars when you compare it to the cost it would be to generate that same amount of water through our hydro facility in Holyrood, right? So our thermal facility in Holyrood. So, when you look at that, that's a fairly big commitment. Another one we have, I guess, which is probably one of the flagships of our group, respective fish issues, is our exploits facility on the Exploits River. I guess it's a fairly large river, as you know. The salmon stocks on that river has been pretty much since the 1960s, probably around 1,200 or so returning salmon. Up to we had a peak, I think, roughly around into 30 to 40,000, range with respect to returning salmon.
Mm-hmm.
From that perspective, I guess, we have a lot of potential impacts with the manager. Obviously, we have three, I guess, when you look at it. You have your Bishop Falls, you have your Grand Falls, and you have a Millertown Dam. Each one of those facilities has its own way to pass fish. So basically, from a downstream perspective, so i.e. the smolt and the kelp, so the spawn salmon coming downstream, we have a way to get them past the dam and back down to the salt water, but also the upcoming fish when they come in through the river to spawn. We have systems whereby the fish can get by the dams to move their way upstream. So, you know, we do have a lot of infrastructure in the Exploits River. We're in, cooperation with the Environment Resources Management Association, otherwise known as IRMA, and also Department of Fisheries and Oceans. So it's a very collaborative approach with respect to the management of fish on the Exploits River. So, and we're just one part of it. Like I said, we do have the infrastructure, but we also manage it in a way to ensure that at different times of the year, we provide the flows that are required either to get the fish into and past these dams, or to ensure that the fish are directed out to where they need to go to get to the salt water. Just to give you an example of that, the Grand Falls facility, we actually have as part of that a smolt diversion system. It's called the louver system. Mm-hmm. So it's basically almost like a boom in the water that is at an angle that the smolt come down, and they're actually directed to a smolt bypass facility where they actually go out over and into the river again, as opposed to going through our turbines. So, and then we also have spillway gates and other facilities along that dam that allows for the smolt to exit without getting harmed.
That's right.
Another one we have is just recently up into, I think, about 2016. If the kelts, which are the spawn salmon, got caught in our power canal, we'd actually get people to come in and seine them. So we'd get a seiner like you would see anywhere else out in the fishery. We have a net where we'd actually get the boats and the people and nets and, you know, get the fish, put them in a truck with aeration, bring them down to a location downstream and release them. Since 2016, what we've been doing is reducing our generation. So basically turn off the generation or power, and the fish will naturally then just kind of go out and seek the flow. When we did have the generation on in Exploits, it took them about 2 days, so 48 hours to kind of get out of the power canal.
Mm-hmm.
They would naturally find their way after a while. But I guess once we see the numbers in our power canal get to a point where we say, okay, well, now we have to shut off the generation, we will, and let them naturally find their way out of the power canal. So, and also, too, I guess in the spring of the year, there's obviously in Exploits River lots of flow because it's a big system. And the flow gates are open, so our spillway gates are open, and the fish naturally go out through the spillway gates. We have another area on the south side of the Grand Falls Dam, which we release about 500 cubic feet per second, and that allows the outgoing fish to kind of do the thing and get kind of attracted to that flow and then move out the system. In our Bishop Falls facility, we also have a bypass facility in place for the outgoing fish. So each one of these structures do have its own unique way of passing fish. So it's just not, you know, we're blocking them under either their inward or their outward migration. So, and we try to minimize that because obviously the fish, when they're coming downstream, they want to get out to the salt water. They want to do their thing. So we don't want to delay them. We want to make sure that they're doing their thing and getting out to the salt water as soon as they can.
Yeah, that's true. So hydro has a history of playing a role in the fish management activity. So how long has there been words on paper regarding that activity? Are we talking like 30, 40 years or just the last 10 years or how long?
Well, I guess since the 1960s we've been involved. I guess, well, it wasn't us at the time, but it was Abitibi.
Yeah.
Involved, and we took on the assets of those during the expropriation. And since then, I guess we've been kind of working through the process with DFO and IRMA to ensure that all of the requirements are met. I guess with respect to the fish migration. And with the other stakeholders, too. I mean, obviously, the Department of Fisheries and Oceans plays a large role. But, the natural salmon runs and Exploits were altered back in the 1960s, as I mentioned, with the, several salmon ladders being built.
Yeah.
And the dams to help to make that upstream and downstream movement quite easy. So we do have fish diversion features, like I mentioned, the louver system. And, from what I've seen, just my, I guess since we've taken it over back in, I can't remember now when it was, but it was probably several years back, that, like I said, it was 1,200 fish that returned. Mm-hmm. To now, I think the bumper year in 2010 was like 47,000, almost 48,000 returning adults.
Yeah.
You know, so and like I said, we have partners like IRMA and DFO, so it makes it easier from a stakeholder perspective. When you do have various interested parties involved, it makes it easier because, again, it's a collaborative approach that you're dealing with each other. You're making sure that, you know, IRMA has the proper water to ensure that their facility is operating properly, because we have to release a certain amount of water to ensure that the fish are coming in and that, you know, enough water is it's available for their system, because, of course, that's a, you know, interpretation center. And, you know, they do have, you know, a viewing area where you can actually go in and see Atlantic salmon migrating upstream, which wasn't in place back in the 1960s. So that's a really a positive in my mind. That's, you know, you're actually allowing people to go in and see the salmon in their true environment to, you know, migrate upstream. So I think that, that builds for the education piece on it and the importance of the Atlantic salmon in that in central Newfoundland.
And that's made a difference, I'm assuming, like you said, from the 60s to now. It has made a difference with increased numbers and more public knowledge of just what's going on in the river, correct?
No, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, one of the things that they've done, I guess, is up, they opened a large portion of the Exploits River that was pretty much impassable. So where the IRMA facility is to our dam facility with the fishway, that pretty much opened up, you know, the rest of the Exploits River. So the Nopal Brook, the Victoria, up in past Millertown Dam. So you have all of the Red Indian Lake facilities. So Mary March Brook, all that was opened up as part of that, you know, when DFO looked at it and said, you know, this is, has more potential. When we did that, or when they did that, it's created a large amount of habitat that the fish could avail of. So it was a major undertaking at that time. And very forward-thinking, as you can imagine, back then to think that way, you know. So you know, kudos on the people like Abitibi and DFO and IRMA to do that. And like I say, we're taking it over on the back end. We're still making sure that same commitment is there. And you know, because we see the value of that resource, that fish resource, to central Newfoundland.
This segment is sponsored by Town of Centerville, Wareham, Trinity, Town of Indian Bay, Sports Fishing Capital of Bonavista North, and Indian Bay Development Committee.
You mentioned fish passages a few times. Each dam, I'm assuming, has a different type of structure and circumstance for that fish management. Is that correct? Like, is there different passages for different dams, or is it all one dam fits all type of thing?
Well, basically, it's the, I guess the dam structure is there. I guess what we try to do, or what has been done on the Exploits in particular, we have structures, well, I guess going down is a little bit easier. You know, we have usually at that time when the there's high flows on, so the fish can either, you know, there's times when on the Exploits that they can go over the dam, because mm-hmm. there's lots of water going over the top of the dam.
Yeah.
We have our spillway gates that they can actually go through, so we open the spillway gates. And on Grand Falls Dam in particular, we do have a notch cut out of the system so that you can actually get the fish down through them in a safe process. The upstream are pretty much the same. It's called a fishway. So basically what you see in any, you know, any system where, you know, a fishway is required, there's various variations depending on the flows, because you try to minimize the flow so the fish can get up there. Obviously, there's velocity issues that you have to worry about when you build these fishways, that, you know, fish aren't going to get impinged on, you know, the walls of the fishway. So, you know, the scientists look at it, they kind of design the fishway so that the fish can actually move up through the ladder in a very systematic approach and then make its way upstream. So, you know, there's ways we do that. And like I said, the incoming salmon are kind of, you know, they're going up through the fishways. The outcoming fish are going through the spillway structures and potentially over the dams in some cases, depending on the volume of water is going. And we do have, like say, passive structures, I guess we want to call it, where the fish just kind of find a flow and just head downstream.
Okay. And besides these fish passage systems, does Hydro do other things to help protect fish populations, be it salmon, trout, any other type of fish?
Yeah, basically we do have, you know, a number of things that we do. Like I mentioned, the flows and the various processes. Like, it's one of the things that comes to mind is the Star Lake system, whereby we actually, as part of, again, of a release through an Environmental Assessment Act, we were required to ensure that the fish populations in the Star Lake system were maintained. So again, we entered into an agreement with Irma to ensure that they would take on. So they actually have a hatchery whereby we take fish out of the system, we rear them in the facility, we get them to a certain size and release them back into Star Lake. So basically, it's an area whereby we're committed to do it. We've been doing it now for the last 20 years. Where we rear the fish, we basically take them and release them back into the Star Lake area to ensure that and these are brook trout, so the brook trout population is not being impacted. And that was a commitment we did because, again, part of the Star Lake facility and the reservoir development, we did flood a lot of land that was considered prime habitat and rearing for the trout population.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what we do every year, we go up and get our brood stock. So we have Irma go up and actually go in and net the area, so they'll get the brood stock. So the larger fish,
okay,
they'll take them into their facility. They'll strip the eggs and the milk. They'll do their fertilization. They'll incubate the eggs, and then the next year they'll take the small fry and release them into our reservoir. So again, a very large commitment that we've been doing over the last 20 years or so to ensure that what was lost is still productive. If that makes sense.
No, that makes sense. I mean, we're kicking around the idea ourselves about hatcheries, and especially here in our watershed area, it's always good to help nature, I guess, repopulate. Especially if there's a benefit to having a steady number of fish, be it salmon, be it trout, and of course, for your circumstances, the more fish in an area, the better it is for nature, from what I can tell. So,
absolutely.
It's all good. Well, that's all the time we have for the day. So I'd like to thank you for being officially our first ever guest on 709.
No, I appreciate it, Darren. And like I said, it's always good to talk about what we do at Newfoundland Labrador Hydro from an environmental perspective. I'm adamant and very passionate about what I do on a day-to-day basis. And like I say, it's always great to talk about, what we do in a positive light, because, again, it's something that I'm quite proud of. And like I said, we do a lot of good work. It's nice to get the opportunity to talk about it.
Awesome. Well, again, thank you for being on the podcast, and I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
We'd like to thank Rod for participating in our first episode. Great information there. Hope you all enjoyed it. Our next episode has a local flair. Curtis Robaum of the Homestead Adventures and Dwayne Collins of Hare Bay Adventures will be in the studio to talk about ecotourism along the shore. Hope you'll tune in for that one. Until then, take care. Goodbye.